This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the August 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. On today's program, because the mainstream as well as the alternative media is largely ignoring or misreporting them, I'll be further examining what I believe are the most crucial questions facing this country at this point in time, compared to which the current run-up to the 2016 presidential election is merely a circus sideshow. The questions: who is going to determine U.S. policy toward Iran, and what is it going to be? Within a few weeks, we should know the answers, whether it will be President Obama or Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the powerful forces he has mobilized in Congress and in the American Jewish establishment on his behalf. The latter, led by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's registered lobby, have brazenly boasted about the millions of dollars they have already spent and the more they plan to spend to defeat the agreement signed on July 15th by the U.S. and the other four permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, plus Germany, with Iran to monitor Tehran's nuclear program. That it has since been approved by all 15 members of the Security Council means nothing to the deal's opponents, who put Israel's perceived interest above all others. To speak with me about this will be retired CIA officer Phil Giraldi, a frequent guest on Takes on the World, who has been closely monitoring the issue and whose most recent article, "Did Iranian Weapons Kill Americans? Another Phony Argument Against a Deal with Iran," appeared on online UNS Review on August 18th. I'll be phoning Phil Giraldi 20 minutes past the hour. Until then, I'll be going over other aspects of the same subject that, because of its sensitive nature, you aren't likely to hear or read anywhere outside of the Israeli and American Jewish press. Here's an example. In the August 21st print edition of The Forward, America's oldest Jewish newspaper, which published weekly but can be read online daily, its former editor and leading opinion writer Jeremy J. Goldberg wrote that, quote, "The campaign against President Obama's Iran nuclear deal tends toward the apocalyptic even when it's in repose. Right now," he writes, "is virtually generals plunging into a swamp of anti-Obama conspiracy theory with a gaggle of conservative pundits openly accusing the president of anti-Semitism. The charge," notes Goldberg, "has been a staple of the extreme far right since Obama first began his White House bid in 2007. Until recent weeks, though, it wasn't common in the mainstream. Now," he writes, "it's spreading like a chemical spill in a coal miner's backyard creek." As the theory goes, said Goldberg, Obama's recent comment about money and lobbyists mobilizing to stop the deal is actually a veiled reference to Jewish donors and pro-Israel lobbyists. In mentioning them, he's supposedly trying to silence his opponents by threatening to unleash the anti-Semites. Not that certain Jewish donors and a brigade of pro-Israel lobbyists aren't mobilizing to stop the deal, wrote Goldberg. They are, energetically. It's just that it's rude to say so. The president is supposed to pretend he didn't notice, end quote. That's from Jeremy J.J. Goldberg in the August 21st Weekly Forward. His book, 1995, Jewish Power, incorporated the two words whose use in tandem is considered taboo when mentioned outside of the confines of the Jewish community, which may partially explain why Noam Chomsky wrote not a word about that notorious display of it in Washington this past March. That's when Netanyahu, breaking all the norms of diplomatic protocol, had Israel's Florida-born ambassador Ron Dermer, a former Republican Party hack, arrange with House Speaker John Boehner for the Israeli Prime Minister to use his visit to AIPAC's National Convention in Washington to address a joint session of Congress. The object of Netanyahu's speech was clear. He would call for Congress to reject any deal negotiated with Iran and supported by the White House that did not totally shut down Tehran's legitimate nuclear enrichment program. That neither the president nor the State Department were informed of the invitation of Netanyahu was without precedent in relations between two sovereign countries, as Israeli columnist Gideon Levy pointed out. It was an example of Jewish power run amok. Had Obama acted forcefully and declared the Israeli ambassador persona non grata and put him on the first plane back to Tel Aviv, when Netanyahu's speech was first announced and publicly advised the Israeli prime minister not to make the speech, he would have no doubt been flayed alive by the Israeli-friendly media. but he would have reminded Israel and its American friends that the White House, at least, was not Israeli-occupied territory. Had Obama gone before the American public to explain his actions, as did the senior George Bush in 1991, to justify his opposition to granting $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel, and why he would veto the expected congressional approval of the Israeli request, Obama, I suspect, would have received the same high approval ratings in the national polls as did Bush. Though I have mentioned it before, that story is worth repeating. When faced with a certain override of his threatened veto, Bush told a nationally televised press conference why, with 1,000 Jewish lobbyists on Capitol Hill at that very moment, he would veto Congress's granting of the loan guarantees request that those lobbyists were pressing Congress to approve. The granting of the guarantees, he told the public, would undermine his efforts to get the Arab countries to resolve their differences with Israel at a planned peace conference in Madrid, to which Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's government was opposed. Bush had also made two demands upon Israel that Shamir rejected. One was that settlement building in the West Bank be halted, and the other was that none of the influx of Russian Jews arriving in Israel would be housed in the occupied West Bank. That brings me back to Chomsky. Bush's actions clearly contradicted Chomsky's long-held position that Israel is a client state of the U.S. and does nothing without Washington's permission. This is why he doesn't write or talk about those actions that contradict that. He would also have us believe that AIPAC and the other Israeli lobbying groups only appear to be influential because they are, in effect, pushing through an open door, that what they are advocating is nothing more than administration policy. In articles that I and others have written, Chomsky's analysis of the Israel-U.S. relationship has been thoroughly shredded and discredited, but the current situation has done so even more dramatically. Which is why, until last Thursday, he had written nothing about the controversy over the Iran agreement. That's when an article of his appeared in The Nation entitled, quote, "The Iranian Threat, Who's the Gravest Danger to World Peace?" End quote. The answer we know without reading it, of course, is the United States. The article has been reproduced on websites all over the internet, as Chomsky's articles, whatever their merit, tend to be. The current piece, despite seemingly overly long, makes no mention of Netanyahu or his pressuring Congress to kill the Iran deal, and there's not even a hint of the money, the ads, and the efforts being extended by AIPAC and other pro-Israel front groups and think tanks to sink the agreement. Consequently, readers unaware of what has been going on behind the scenes would be forgiven for thinking that Obama is opposed to the agreement. In reference to the possibility of a nuclear-free Middle East, Chomsky writes of, quote, "Washington's continuing sabotage of the effort in order to protect its Israeli client." After all, Chomsky suggests, this is not the only case in which opportunities to end the alleged Iranian threat have been undermined by Washington, raising further questions about just what is actually at stake, end quote. What it should raise are questions as to why Chomsky would write an article about the Iran agreement that so egregiously provides protective cover for Netanyahu and the Israeli lobbyists who are leading the efforts to derail it. His only two references to Obama in the article are both negative and give no indication of the importance Obama has placed on the success of the agreement, nor that his Secretary of State John Kerry was the P5 plus one's chief negotiator. It has been a full decade since I wrote an article for Left Curve magazine entitled, quote, "Damage Control, Noam Chomsky in the Israel-Palestine Conflict," that shined a harsh light on Chomsky's record on this issue. Although Left Curve went out of existence with the passing of its editor, Shabba Polony, at the end of 2013, the article can still be found online by doing a search. Why this special attention to Chomsky, you may ask? It's because he has long been considered the leading guru of the American liberal left, so what he says or doesn't say about a critical issue of the day is of importance. While speaking or writing about Jewish power is clearly a taboo subject for Chomsky, it has lately become a source of concern for many American Jews. The ham-handed efforts of Netanyahu and his American shills to exert that power and kill the Iran agreement has understandably angered and worried American Jews who do not appreciate an Israeli prime minister telling them to choose him over their president. For him to have done so predictably raised the question of dual loyalty, another touchy subject in the Jewish community. This is apparently what led 26 members of an earlier generation of Jewish leaders, including a former head of AIPAC, to take a public stance in favor of the Iran agreement last Thursday. It took the usual form of a full-page ad in the New York Times and featured a quote by Ami Yalon, a former head of Shin Bet, Israel's intelligence service, and retired Navy admiral, stating that, quote, "When it comes to Iran's nuclear capability, this deal is the best option." Beneath it and above the signatures were the predictable statements denouncing Iran as, quote, "unflinchingly anti-Semitic," end quote, an allegation that's belied by the protection that Tehran affords its Jewish population, and, quote, "an unapologetic state sponsor of terrorism," end quote, a category in which Iran lags far behind the United States, Israel, and Israel's new ally, Saudi Arabia. That's not the point of the ad, however, but more the signatories' way of indicating they have not become fans of the Ayatollah Khamenei. Apart from the two well-known former chairs of the Conference of Major Jewish American Organizations, Seymour Reich and Alan Solow, a big backer of Obama, the most significant name on the ad was that of Tom Dine, who is AIPAC's executive director from 1980 to 1993, is credited with building the organization to what it has become today, the most powerful and feared lobby in Washington. It was Dine who, in his second year on the job, publicly challenged President Reagan over his decision to sell the AWACS early warning system to the Saudis in 1981 and forced the popular president to twist arms to get the deal passed the Senate by a two-vote majority. It was also Dine who vowed to take down Bush after the president took his case against Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees, which I mentioned earlier, to the American people. Meanwhile, both sides are going all out to woo members of Congress to their position. When Gerald Nadler, a staunch supporter of Israel, became the first Jewish member of New York's congressional delegation to announce his support for the agreement after receiving a personal letter from Obama, he immediately became the target of New York's virulent Israel firsters. The most prominent was New York State Assemblyman Dov Hykund, who is Orthodox Jew. He threatened to raise millions of dollars to challenge Nadler in next year's primaries. Hykund was once an important figure in the racist Rabbi Meir Kahane's Jewish Defense League, which was labeled by Washington as a terrorist group. "Most hurtful is people asserting, shouting that somehow I'm anti-Israel," Nadler said. "I've been a supporter of Israel my whole life," end quote. Nadler noted that Obama had promised to provide additional military support for Israel on top of the $1.9 billion in arms he provided a couple of months ago that was only reported in Israel, the American Jewish press, and right here on Takes on the World. So far, only two of the six Democrats required to vote with the 54 Republicans to defeat the deal have announced they will do so. New York's Charles Schumer, whose pledge of loyalty to Israel I played for you on my last program, and New Jersey's Robert Menendez, who has co-sponsored previous bills levying sanctions on Iran. Last Wednesday, if you were up early and had your radio tuned to KZYX, you would have heard the takeaway John Hockenberry exposed Menendez's hypocrisy during a very gutsy 8-minute interview, most of which was filled with the Cuban Americans' regurgitation of AIPAC's talking points. When he stopped to take a breath, that's when Hockenberry challenged him. Let's listen to this two-minute, 17-second exchange.
"But wouldn't your position look a little bit more consistent if you argued for Israel to apply Security Council resolutions and actually sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, get them to do that? Otherwise, this looks like you're simply agreeing with Israel on a policy decision that has very little to do with the United States and a lot more to do with Israel."
Well, listen, John, first of all, to think that you can reassemble the sanctions regime as someone who was the author of it, who prodded the administration to make sure they did the regulations and then the enforcement, and to give companies and countries notice when you start sanctioning again, you give them at least 6 months. And the time frame to go ahead and pursue actionable items on that will be well in the year breakout time. So the breakout time will have meant nothing in the context of sanctions. That's why snapback under this guise, as devised under this agreement, is a fantasy. As to the broader question you raise, look, as far as I'm concerned, we have Security Council resolutions as it relates to Iran. We have a country that is exporting terrorism, the single state sponsor of terrorism in the world, with Assad in Syria, with the Houthis in Yemen, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, even with what they're doing in Iraq, their designs in Bahrain. That is a totally different question, and that is the question at hand.
Is it a totally different question? I mean, if I would agree to everything that you say, wouldn't it be a matter of good faith to get Israel to sign the nonproliferation treaty, even if you're going to vote against this? And if you're so concerned about Iran's terrorist activities, which are well documented, why are you opposed to the Goldstone report, which accuses the Israeli government of targeting Palestinian civilians in Gaza?
Well, you want to keep mixing.
Mixing? No. I'm not mixing anything.
I think they are totally two separate differences. Number one is you're talking about a democracy versus a theocracy that is pursuing its revolutionary goals throughout the region and destabilizing
Senator,
the region.
Senator, as far as I know, you know Israel as well that. As I do, that is a rhetorical dodge. These are both civilians, Palestinian civilians.
No, I think your question is a rhetorical dodge to the substantive question of worrying about Iran as a nuclear state.
Well, you're not going to. That was John Hockenberry grilling Robert Menendez like he has never been grilled before, and you're not going to hear that kind of questioning very often on American radio. It was here on KZYX last Wednesday morning, John Hockenberry. Robert Menendez was the Senate's leading recipient of pro-Israel contributions in 2012, which won't come as a surprise. And in April, when he was indicted on corruption charges and removed as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, established a fundraising committee. And in July, the New York Times reported Menendez raised nearly $1.6 million for his legal defense fund, including some from the country's most prominent pro-Israel billionaires. Finally, while we keep hearing about Iran's alleged threats to wipe Israel off the map, it seems that it was Netanyahu that was planning to launch an attack on Iran in 2010-2011, according to secret recordings released to the Israeli media by former Defense Minister Ehud Barak. According to reports of the recordings in the Israeli press, Netanyahu, supported by Barak, wanted to strike at Iran's nuclear facilities in 2010 and 2011, as I mentioned, but was prevented from doing so first by his army chief of staff and then by ministerial colleagues. In 2010, the plans were blocked by Chief of Staff Gabi Ashkenazi, who said the Israeli military was not ready for the operation, and then the following year by fellow cabinet ministers Moshe Bogi-Yalan and Yuval Steinitz. Yalan is currently Israel's defense minister and Steinitz its energy minister. The strikes were planned to take place because Netanyahu and Barak anticipated that Iran's nuclear facilities would become so well protected as to render an attack on them either a short-term solution or futile in preventing Iran from attaining nuclear weapons. What the reports of the broadcast do not mention, but what I previously reported is that Israeli intelligence documents from that period indicate that Iran was not engaged in any nuclear weapons activity. Netanyahu still insists that Israel will act alone if necessary to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And to assist him in doing that, as I noted on an earlier program, one of Israel's main agents in Washington, the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, has urged that Washington provide Israel with a mass of bunker buster bombs and the aircraft and training required to drop them on Iran. And this is Jeff Blankfurt. Thank you for listening.